Thank you. Thank you, Chuck. I've been giving a lot of thought, to maybe too much thought, to what kind of words could possibly match the weight of this moment in history, as the nations of the world and, you know, seemingly every non-governmental organization on the planet that has anything to do with climate, environment, energy, economic development, poverty, health, human rights. And let us not forget the corporations. Ah, yes, the corporations and their lobbyists. And not just corporations and NGOs and world leaders, but people, like actual people, citizens from all over the world, are all converging on the city of Paris in an effort to coordinate and push and prod and, in some cases, obstruct an unprecedented and some would say impossible global response to our now all but certain global climate catastrophe. This catastrophe that is unfolding before our eyes. And attempting to do so, as of last Friday, in the midst of violence and fear and repression, in the midst of what looks a lot like war. So, I mean, what words could possibly match the weight of this moment? So over the past few days, I've kept coming back to the last two stanzas of a poem that was written in New York City on the very night that a war broke out in Europe, a war that everyone saw coming, a war that changed everything. A war that would produce human suffering on a scale never before seen, a scale never before imagined, including massive numbers of refugees. People with nowhere to go and nothing left to do but throw themselves at the mercy of their fellow human beings. The poem was written by an English poet who had recently left England to come to this country, who was already at the age of 32, one of the greatest poets in the English language. A poet, a man of the left, a gay man, and, as it happens, a Christian. And on that night in New York City, as he sat in one of the dives on 52nd Street, and as violence and hate and fear tore Europe apart, he began to write what would become these words. All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man in the street, and the lie of authority whose buildings grope the sky. There is no such thing as the state, and no one exists alone. Hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. We must love one another and die. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. And yet, dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. Whiston Hugh Auden, W. H. Auden, September 1st, 1939. May I show an affirming flame. I'll let you in on a little secret. That was almost the epigraph of this book. And you know, maybe it should have been. So yeah, I've written a book. There it is. It's just a book. It's just one imperfect book, words on pages. And I'm just one writer, one very imperfect writer, trying to find the words to match this moment on our planet. And I'm the first to admit that I failed. I mean, I knew I would fail. I could only have failed. In fact, you know, to be honest, the overriding emotion that I have felt in the year since I finished writing this book and prepared to go out and talk about it, and in fact, have gone out and talked about it a lot, is frankly sorry. It's true. What I mainly feel is sorry. I feel like I owe everybody who's in this book, every single one of them, some sort of apology, because I'm sorry that it's not better. They deserve better. My children deserve better. All of you deserve better. The world needed and needs a far better book than I was able to give it. You know, as Samuel Beckett said, ever tried, ever failed. Try again, fail again, fail better. So I tried and failed to convey the true lived experience of the people that I wrote about, and I failed to convey the depth and intensity of my own anguish and my own fear and my own anger, no, rage, at what's happening to my children's world. And yeah, I admit my own despair. The book doesn't even come close to conveying these things. And of course, you know, maybe I am being too hard on myself. I mean, maybe no book possibly could, no words could ever really fully capture these things. And maybe if it could, nobody would ever come near it. So at some point, I decided, rather than write only out of anguish and fear and rage and despair, none of which I could even come close to conveying, maybe I should write out of love. Just love. The love that contains all of those things, the anguish, the fear, the anger, the despair, and yet much, much more. Because it's so much larger infinitely larger than my small and inconsequential feelings and my small and inconsequential self. You know, maybe if I could just capture enough of it, just some small fraction of it, then maybe I could help other people who, like me, are struggling to come to terms with the weight of this moment. And maybe help them come to terms with it in a way that might move them and move me beyond words, to action, So I guess if this 240-page book could somehow be boiled down into a few paragraphs, I suppose it might be these from the opening pages. This is really happening. The Arctic and the glaciers are melting. The oceans are rising and acidifying. The corals are bleaching. The great forests dying and burning. The storms and floods, the droughts and heat waves are intensifying. The farms and savannas are parched and drying. Nations are disappearing. War is raging. People are dying. Mass extinction is unfolding. And all of it sooner and faster than science predicted. The window in which to prevent the worst scenarios is closing before our eyes. And the fossil fuel industry, which holds the fate of humanity in its carbon reserves, has doubled down economically and politically on all this destruction, on business as usual. We face an unprecedented situation, a radical situation. It demands a radical response. That is a serious response. Because let's be clear, given what we know and have known for decades about climate change, indeed, what we now know ExxonMobil has known for decades about climate change, to deny the science, deceive the public, and willfully obstruct any serious response to this catastrophe is to allow entire countries and cultures to disappear. It is to rob people of their land, their homes, their livelihoods, even their lives, and their children's lives, and their children's children's lives, for profit and for political power. There's a word for this. These are crimes. They are crimes against the earth, and they are crimes against humanity. They are crimes against humanity. So where does this leave us? I mean, how does one respond to something like that? Remain calm, we're told. No scare tactics or hysterics, please. Cooler heads will prevail. Enjoy the Earth Day festivities. I'm sorry, but the cooler heads have not prevailed. It's been a quarter century since the alarm was sounded. The cooler heads have failed. You want sweet, cool-headed reason? How about this? Masses of people, most of them young, a generation with little or nothing to lose, physically, non-violently disrupting the fossil fuel industry and the institutions that support it and abet it. Getting in the way of business as usual. Forcing the issue. Finally acting as though we actually believe what the science is telling us. And as though we actually care about our fellow human beings. Isn't that a bit extreme? Really? Extreme? Business as usual is extreme. Just ask a climate scientist. The building is burning. The innocents, the poor, the oppressed, the children, your own children, are inside. And the American petrostate, which under the all of the above energy policies of Barack Obama, has overtaken Saudi Arabia as the largest oil producer on the planet, is spraying fuel, not water, fuel on the flames. That's more than extreme. It's homicidal. It's psychopathic. It's fucking insane. Look, this is hard. Coming to terms with the climate catastrophe is hard. It's frightening, it's infuriating, it's heartbreaking. A friend of mine, a young woman who's in this book, says that it's like walking around with a knife in your chest. And so I ask again, in the face of this situation, in the face of despair, how does one respond? Rather than retreat into various forms of denial and fatalism and cynicism, more and more people, and especially that young generation of activists, have reached the conclusion that something more than merely environmentalism and virtuous green consumerism is called for. That the only thing offering any chance of averting a truly apocalyptic future, and just as important, of getting through what we know is already coming with our humanity intact, is the kind of radically transformative social and political movement that has changed the course of history in the past. A movement like those that have made possible what was previously unthinkable, whether the abolition of slavery or civil rights or on down the list. On September 21st, 2014, last year, some 300,000 or 400,000 people came out on the streets of Manhattan for the historic People's Climate March. And one of the slogans for that march was, "To change everything, we need everyone." And I couldn't agree more. In some ways, that's what this book is about. But here's what would really change everything. First, acknowledging that the mainstream environmental movement and the corporate-controlled political system through which it has tried to work for decades has failed. That we've already lost the quote-unquote climate fight. If that means, quote, solving the climate crisis and saving any semblance of the world that we know. That it was lost before it began because it got started so late. And that it's time now to fight like there's nothing left to lose but our humanity. You know, where does the courage and the commitment and the sacrifice required for that kind of a struggle, for the kind of radical movement that we really need, where does that actually come from? What I've found in the stories of the people profiled in this book and of many others is that the climate struggle, like so many struggles of the past, is essentially a spiritual struggle. That there is a kind of spiritual crisis at the heart of the climate crisis. Because it forces us to confront the deepest, most difficult questions about ourselves. The climate catastrophe is so fundamental that it strikes to the root of who we are. It's a radical situation. It requires a radical response, but not necessarily radical in the conventional sense of ideology. There's that too. Don't get me wrong, there's still ideology. But rather, I'm talking about something else. It confronts us with a kind of radical necessity, a moral necessity. It requires us to wake up, to find out who we really are, and to act. In some cases, to lay everything on the line. Our relationships, our reputations, our careers, our bodies, maybe even our lives. And so, in this book, I've written merely from my own experience, my own personal journey into the climate movement in the United States, about a few of the people I've come to know who have committed their lives and at times risked everything to help inspire and build a more powerful and enduring movement in this country. And three of them are sitting right behind me. People who have honestly confronted despair, a despair fully justified by our situation, and yet somehow have found the resolve to fight, to keep fighting. And this book represents no more and no less than my own search for the moral and spiritual wellsprings of that kind of courage and commitment, and my search for what the very idea of climate justice at this late hour might yet mean. Okay. So I have some introductions to make. Who should I start with? Jay O'Hara. Jay O'Hara. Jay grew up on Cape Cod. Just over the bridge in the town of Bourne, he told me. And Jay is a Quaker. Full stop. The first time he told me that, when I was interviewing him, it took me a while to get my head around that concept. Jay, I asked, do you consider yourself an environmentalist or, you know, a climate activist or maybe a climate justice activist or what, you know? I'm a Quaker. That's all he said. And he explained in some rather colorful language that probably shouldn't be repeated here exactly what he thinks of those other labels that we apply to ourselves and to other people and to our movements. You just have to read the book for that. On May 15th, 2013, Jay and a fellow activist named Ken Ward, a good friend of many of us here in the room, put their bodies in the way of a 40,000-ton shipment of coal. Anchoring their 30-foot lobster boat, which they named the Henry David T, in the path of a 682-foot coal tanker called the Energy Enterprise at the Brayton Point Power Station in Somerset, and risked going to prison in order to do so. Jay's and Ken's stories are at the heart of the book. And as I write there in chapter 4, It's all about them, just called We Have to Shut It Down. Ken and Jay dramatized the stark choices we face as a society and a species. They want us to understand. As human beings, we can have coal plants or we can have a livable future, but we can't have both. Marla Markham. Marla is a dear friend of Jay's and of Ken's and of Tim's and of mine. As I say in the book, Marla reminds me of my own sisters. And she is like a sister to me. Marla grew up on a small farm in the Ozarks of Missouri, where her family struggled. And she was raised in a strong Methodist congregation, which she credits with teaching her the essentials of community organizing. And she went on to train for the United Methodist Clergy at the Boston University School of Theology. But before she could be ordained, she took the leap into full-time climate organizing. And she co-founded a group called Better Future Project and the Climate Summer Program, and as well as 350 Massachusetts. And she's really one of the core organizers of our regional grassroots climate movement. And she was also a core member, maybe the core member, of Jay's and Ken's support team for their lobster boat action. She was with them every step of the way, I think it's fair to say. There's a scene in the book, which I won't spoil for you, but where Marla is standing with Jay and Ken on the docks in Newport, Rhode Island, as the sun was coming up on the day of their action. And they asked her to offer a prayer. And so she improvised, a prayer of dedication. We give you thanks this day, she prayed, for your call to love the world and to change it. And she prayed that the gifts we offer this day transform the hearts of many, just as our own hearts are being transformed. It's hard to think of anyone I know who has transformed more hearts, including mine, than Tim DeChristopher. Tim was born in the West Virginia coal country and grew up there and in Pittsburgh before lighting out for the territories, to college in Arizona and worked in the Ozarks and ended up in Utah, where he finally became an economics student at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Tim is a student at Harvard Divinity School and studying for the Unitarian Universalist ministry. Yeah, let's hear it for the UUs. And now, Tim, I think it's fair to say, Tim did not follow what one could call an orthodox path to divinity school, though I would call it a sacred path. See, Tim is considered by the United States government to be a felon. He went to Harvard Divinity School by way of prison, after nearly 2 years in federal custody, because he stood up for justice, for climate justice. And I'm sure many of you know the story about how in December 2008, Tim put his own freedom on the line to stop a corrupt federal auction of leases to drill for oil and gas on public lands in southern Utah. And not only to stop that auction, but to tell the world that if we're serious about climate change and climate justice, then we have to start keeping that oil and gas in the ground. And so, acting spontaneously on his conscience, Tim raised his paddle and won bids for 22,000 acres worth nearly $2 million, which, of course, as a student, he had no way of paying. But he did pay. He paid with nearly 2 years of his life. And at his sentencing, Tim told the judge, "This is what love looks like, and it will only grow." Tim DeChristopher is one of the people in this world, along with Jay and Ken and Marla, who woke me up intellectually, morally, spiritually, who helped me understand what it is that we're really fighting for. And so, Tim, Marla, Jay, I will never find the words to thank you enough. Thank you.